of the grandeur of the heavens and was pondering how the Creator that stretched out the heavens, and as the psalmist says in another place, tellest all the stars by their names, how this Creator could take note of this fallen flesh of which we're made. And when we think about this phrase, it's easy to lose and not reflect on what it means to be God's people. That the Creator that stretched out the heavens, this eternal infinite being, is actually willing to take out of this flesh and blood fallen race of Adam some, and to designate them and to hold them and to bring them unto himself as his people. That's a stupendous thought. And for those people to be able to identify that Creator as their God, because the phrase is worded here twice. So, as we think about the phrase, as we work with it this morning, we need to try to impress on our minds the wonderful thought, the wonderful message that it conveys. What is it called, a couplet? Well, it's called a couplet. We're going to talk a little bit about the literary structure. A couplet is a unit of verse consisting of two successive lines, usually rhyming and having the same meter and often forming a complete thought or a syntactic unit. That means a unit with the same meaning, or two similar things of pair. And I would suggest to you that in the wording of that phrase, we have the essence of a couplet. The first part of the phrase, they shall be my people, and the second part, I will be their God, express a couplet. None of us, I believe, speak the Hebrew language, and we're not able to determine whether in Hebrew it rhymes or not. That is something I don't know. Certainly it doesn't rhyme in English, and I don't know whether it rhymes in Hebrew. But it is, whether it rhymes or not, it meets the test of a couplet. Now there is another grammatical structure that is less commonly known, and I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing this word right. It's a Greek word, and I believe the CH sound is pronounced as a hard sound, so I'm going to pronounce it chiasmus. This structure is also a chiasmus, and it's from a Greek verb which means to shape like the letter X. It's a figure of speech in which two or more clauses are related to each other through a reversal of structures in order to make a larger point. That is, the clauses display inverted parallelism. And I would suggest to you that the phrase we're dealing with, those 12 words, conform to that definition, that they display an inverted parallelism. And as we go through the verses today, we're not going to go through all 30 of them by any means, but we will look at a selection of them. I think that that meaning will become clearer. So, when we have this concept that there is, out of this mass of humanity, a group of people that God is going to designate as his people, there's a lot of implications to that concept right off the bat. It also implies that there's a group of people that God does not view as his people, that there's a segmentation of the human race into two groups, those that are his people and those that are not his people. And if God is going to be the God of certain ones, he says, I will be their God, then it implies then that he is not the God of others. Now, in one sense, the scriptures describe our God as the God of the spirit of all flesh, of the spirits of all flesh. So God, in one sense, is the God of every living thing, in the sense of being the creator and sustainer of all life. As Job said, God holds in his hand the breath of every living thing. But there's a specific sense in which God describes himself, I will be their God. And I think for the purposes of a synonym in that expression, what we could say that verse is conveying is that God is saying, I will be their salvation. That there's this people that God has ordained for a people unto himself. He's going to redeem that people. He's going to save that people. He's going to bring that people unto himself, and in time, endow that people with his divine nature. So that is the essence of the purpose of God that is expressed within that couplet. So I'd like to just take a few minutes and engage your thought in this idea of the selection process that's going on the face of the earth. I'm not sure how well you can see these slides. The one on your left is a picture that is generally viewed as the largest gathering of human beings that occurs annually on the face of the earth. You might go to the local stadium here in Denver. I don't know how many people it holds, but let's say it holds 80,000 people. This gathering here ranges between 3 and 4 million people, and it's the largest concentration of people coming together for an event on the earth at one time. If you can recognize it in the center of the picture here, the little tiny dots you see are not pixels, they're actually people. And I don't know how many are actually in the picture, but probably over 1 million in that picture alone. That's the Kabbalah stone in the center of Mecca, and this is the Hajj, where every year devout Muslims make a pilgrimage to Mecca during the month of Ramadan. And that's the largest gathering in one place on the face of the earth. The one on the right, it's not Denver. It is a city set in mountains, as you can see, very populous city. It's one of the more populous metropolitan areas in North America. That's Mexico City. And there's upwards of 15 million people. So if you think the traffic's bad in Denver, you can imagine if you had, perhaps 10 times as many people, what it would be like. And that's how many live in that bowl between the mountains in inland Mexico, in Mexico City. So again, just to give us some sense of the immensity of people that dwell on the face of the earth. And we have in Psalm, it's in a psalm twice, both Psalm 53 and Psalm 14. It begins with this phrase, "The Lord looked down from heaven." Why did the Lord look down from heaven? What was the point in that psalm of looking down from heaven? It's actually, why don't we just open our Bibles to Psalm 14 rather than my attempting to quote it and quoting it incorrectly. The psalm is almost identical with Psalm 53. It's a psalm that begins with the fool saying in his heart, "There is no God," and describing how those who have adopted that conclusion in life become corrupt. And then in verse 2 we have this phrase, "The Lord looked down from heaven upon the children of men." Why was God looking down? What is his purpose in looking down on this mass of people on the face of the earth? The United Nations estimates there's 6.7 billion of us, and by the year 2050 that number will increase to 9.2 billion. So just a phenomenal number of people on the face of the earth. And the Almighty looks down on this great mass of humanity. For what purpose? To see if there were any that did understand and seek God. So the Almighty is looking down to see, out of this mass of humanity, are there any that understand what he's trying to achieve, not what he's trying to achieve, but what he is working out, what the purpose he is accomplishing is. And are there any out of this mass of humanity that are seeking him diligently with their whole heart? That is what he's looking down to see. And when he looks down on the gathering in Mecca, which occurred last month, does he see that? Does he see people that are seeking God with their whole heart? Does he see people that understand his purpose? Well, he sees people that have a zeal of God, of Allah in their God, but not according to knowledge. This whole stone is all mixed up with ancient moon god ritual, and he's seeing people that are enslaved to a religious system of thought that is not the system of understanding that he's revealed in the Word of God. When he looks on a major city like Mexico City and sees all those millions and millions of people going about their daily business, are they understanding? Are they seeking him in the things they're doing? So this is what God is seeking out of this fallen race of Adam as people that understand and seek him. What Brother Dick was referring to last night in scriptures as the remnant. Now there have been, in the history of the human race, different periods of time when ideas particularly flourished. There's been other periods which were called the Dark Ages, when ideas were stifled, when ideas didn't flourish. But there have been periods when ideas really flourished. And one of those periods was the early part of the Victorian era of the world, in the middle of the 19th century. There were a lot of books written. It was a time of ideas to be discussed and debated. One of those books that was written that had a great influence on civilization was Darwin's book. It was published in 1859 for the first time, The Origin of Species. And we don't generally read the full title. It's often just called The Origin of Species. But if you look at the full title that's on the screen there, it's a book about selection. And the subtitle is, By Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Now, this is a book that presented a paradigm of what the selection process of life and existence was all about. And it's a paradigm that is without God. It doesn't have anything to do with the concept of Psalm 14. There's no God looking down, according to this book, seeking to make a choice out of this fallen human race for his eternal purpose. It's just nature has a process at work making selection. Now I'm going to ask you to indulge me twice this morning for what I call digressions from our main theme. I'm going to make such a digression now, so bear with me for a couple of minutes, because I read a book over the last 8 weeks or so, and I wanted to make a brief reference to it. There was at Cornell University, which is in the Finger Lakes region of New York State, a professor named John Sanford, who was an active and ardent evolutionist for most of his life. And towards the end of his working life, shortly before he retired, in 2005, he came to the conclusion that what he called the fundamental axiom of Darwin's theory was not supported by the evidence, that it couldn't be sustained. And to announce his view to the world, he published a book called Genetic Entropy. And his specialization was in the area of genetics, horticulture, crop genetics specifically. He was involved with the New York State Department of Agriculture as part of his extension work with the university. And he was one of the scientists that developed what has been called the gene gun that enabled genetic modification to be made to plant organisms. Those of you that have an agricultural bent will know that most of the soybeans and corn grown in the United States are genetically modified organisms to achieve different benefits for those who grow the crops. And he was involved in an earlier part of his career in developing the technology that allowed those genetic modifications to be inserted into the genetic structure of crops like corn and soybean. Well, anyways, what's the book Genetic Entropy about, if we had to summarize it in a minute or two? His conclusion, the whole premise of Darwin's theory is, the whole basis on which natural selection is supposed to work, is that as each generation reproduces, it reproduces slightly different genetically than the previous generation. And the differences are referred to as mutations, which is simply a fancy word for changes. So there's changes in the genetic structure, and the idea of Darwin's theory was that there are environmental forces that choose among the variations, and those forces over time make choices, make what is called natural selection. They make selections that the organisms actually change and, in fact, improve over time. And so you know the concept of the theory is that from very single-celled life, we've moved through those changes into human beings over a long period of time. Now, it's not my purpose this morning to address that theory in any detail at all, except to share with you what the evidence showed from Professor Sanford's view. And what the evidence showed was that while it is true that those changes occur and that they are cumulative, that in fact they are cumulatively degenerative, which means that in fact instead of an organism actually improving each time it reproduces, the progeny are slightly less genetically stable than the parents. And if you think about that, if we are parents, we might get some comfort in explaining that to our children, but we might not want to share that with our parents if they're not in the room today. But if you think about that, what it means is that as these changes have accumulated in the genetic structure, the human race has become less stable or more inferior genetically. And Professor Sanford provides a lot of evidence in his book that that is the case. But there's some very simple evidence that we don't need to have a degree in genetics to understand. Why is it that the laws of most civilized countries forbid brothers and sisters in the flesh to marry? The reason is there's a very high risk of congenital defects resulting. Many states and provinces of Canada, they're referred to as the laws against consanguinity, also ban first cousins marrying. And the reason is because if there's very close intermarriage in a family, there's a very elevated risk of a genetic defect occurring in the children. Why is that risk higher? The risk is higher because in our genetic structure, we have a lot of genetic baggage of deleterious mutations. And as long as we marry someone who is not closely related to us, there's a very low probability that those genetic mutations that are deleterious, because of the way that dominant and recessive genes work, that they're going to find expression. We're still going to carry them in our genetic structure, but they're not going to be expressed. But when two people who are very closely related marry, there's a very high probability, or much higher probability, that they will be expressed. And so if you think about the implications of his book, that genetic change over time is actually a downward progression, an accumulation of genetic baggage and genetic mistakes, I guess we could call them. The implications are that at a point in time, if we go back in time, the human race genetically was more intact, was you might say, more solid. And that's consistent with the scriptures, because we do read about brothers and sisters marrying at an earlier stage of the human history. And it was okay then. There wasn't the genetic risk because the human race had not accumulated the baggage, so to speak, that it has today. And so that is a witness to the truth of the scriptures and the truth of the paradigm we subscribe to in opposition to Darwin's paradigm. Because if we are, in fact, genetically becoming inferior with each successive generation, then there must have been a time in the past when we were superior. And that could only have come about as a result of an act of divine creation. So thanks for bearing with that digression. We're going to come back now to the 1850s, when there were ideas coming forward. People were presenting ideas, some of which had a profound effect in shaping the world. And at the beginning of that decade, there was another book written with which we're much more familiar. This particular edition is dated, if you can see it at the bottom, 1910. But the first American edition was published, I believe, in 1851. I have a copy of one at home. It was published in the British Isles the previous year. And it was written by Brother John Thomas Elpis Israel. And Brother Thomas set out a paradigm of seeking to elucidate, to explain a whole number of things in the scriptures. But one of the things this book does is it really does explain the meaning of the precious couplet without doing so in so many words. It's all about the concept that is inherent in the precious couplet that we're going to be looking at this morning. This is a slide of a person taking some sand at a big sieve. In case you can't see it at the back clearly, they're pushing some sand through a big sieve, trying to get the finer particles to fall through. This kind of technology, if you want to call it that, is pretty simple technology. This kind of manual technology is widely used in archaeological digs where some earth is gathered in and then it's sorted in a sieve, so that the sand and the dust falls through and what are perhaps the archaeological relevant pieces can be recovered and cataloged and investigated as to what they are. So we can think of a sieve like this that the Almighty, in one place in the prophecy of Isaiah chapter 30, says that he will sift the nations with a sieve of vanity. This is part of God's process of working with this human material, this genetic material, all descended from Adam, of which we are made, of working with us to see if there were any among us that did understand and that did seek him. Now, I think we can make the observation, this is another digression, it's not one of the ones I asked you to indulge, but we'll do it anyways. At the Canadian Bible School this last summer, a brother from Arkansas approached me and recommended that I read a book by J. Scott Adams called God's Debris. Have any of you ever heard of that book? In his circles, it was a widely read book. And I wouldn't recommend that you go out and buy it, but because he recommended that I read it, I did buy it, and I did read it in the month of August. J. Scott Adams may be recognized by some of you as the creator of the Dilbert comic strip. But it's not a comic strip book. It's a book where he has two characters. One of them is a UPS or FedEx delivery person, and the other one is a very elderly man who's receiving a parcel. And at the time of the delivery, they get into a dialogue about some very profound questions about the meaning of life and human existence. And they have this dialogue back and forth in the book. And in the preface, the author says, "Don't accuse me of believing any of the things that are said in the book." It's a very convenient way, because if you write a dialogue like that and somebody says, "Well, I don't agree with it," he can say, "Well, that's not what I uphold myself. That was just what the character in the book was thinking, but it wasn't my own personal point of view." So it was kind of a crafty way, perhaps, of writing without him having to defend the position that the old man took in the book in explaining things. But it's kind of a new age view, I guess, of human existence. Just to give you an example, in the book, there's a chapter where there's a number of bees on the panes of a stained glass window of a church, and they're all looking into the church, and because the panes are different colors, they all see different things inside the church. And in his paradigm, humanity is like bees looking into things, and everybody sees religion a little bit differently, but they're all valid because they're all just looking in through different colored panes. That's a very contemporary paradigm of religion. So why mention J. Scott Adams' book? Because as I read the book, it struck me that there was one thing that was totally missing from his book. And that was, he made no provision for there being a divine revelation. And if I could make the comment, this changes everything. The fact we have a divine revelation, we're no longer bees on the panes of a stained glass window, we're beings that were given an intellect and the capacity to open and read. And this is how we're going to fulfill the requirements of Psalm 14. This is the only place we're going to get understanding about what God's purpose is. It's only through the pages of this book. And it struck me that in the paradigm of God's debris, there was no place for divine revelation. There was no place for the almighty being whom we serve and worship giving us that understanding through the pages of his word. Now we're going to look at a very well-known verse that I think is very relevant to the precious couplet. That's in Acts chapter 15. In Acts chapter 15, we don't have time to talk about the chapter at length this morning, but it's the one place in the Bible where there was a controversy among brethren, and the chapter unfolds, you might say, a process by which that controversy was settled. Now they had, we could say, the advantage that we don't have, in that when they reached their conclusions at the end of the conference there, they were able to say that their conclusions were endorsed by the Spirit of God. So they were able to send a letter summarizing their conclusions, in which they could say that they had the authority of God's Holy Spirit endorsing what they had written. We don't have that opportunity when there's a controversy among brethren. But the model that arises from that chapter is that when brethren differ, they get together with their Bibles open, because that's what they did there. They had a question about whether it was necessary for Gentiles believers to keep the law of Moses and be circumcised, and they came together as brethren to consider the question. And they did so with open Bibles, and they apparently addressed each other in the conference and the discussion in a civil way, in a kindly way as brethren. They opened their Bible, and they tried to reason from the Scriptures what God's will in the matter was, and that's how they were able to bring resolution. And in the context of that discussion, Simeon, we don't have what Simeon said, we have what one of the other brothers in the conference reporting what Simeon had told the conference. Simeon hath declared how God at the first did visit the Gentiles to take out of them a people for his name. And that verse, we understand, encapsulates the purpose of God, that God, looking down from heaven, visited the Gentiles by giving an understanding and issuing a call to take out of the Gentiles that mass of humanity, of people, to bear his name. The question then that arises to us is, when did that occur in the history of the human race? Well, I think we can, the key word here is the word Gentiles. When was the first segregation made where Gentiles were differentiated in some way from the rest of the human race? And the answer, I believe, was when Abraham was called. And that's what this map shows. Abraham was first called out of Ur. He went into Egypt. As was noted last night, there was a famine. And then he came back to the land that he was promised, in which he was living at the time of his death. We also know that in the next generation, in the line of Abraham, a further differentiation was made. Abraham was called out of the Gentiles, and then a differentiation was made in his family, in the declaration that was made, "In Isaac shall thy seed be called." And there's something in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, that I want to draw to your attention, because I think it gives us some sense of appreciation for the God whom we worship and his relationship to this people he's taking out for his name. This occurs in Hebrews 11, verses 8, the whole section would be verses 8 to 19, where the faith of the patriarchs is cited, but we're just going to look at verse 16. "But now they desire a better country, that is, in heavenly." And then this is the part that I want you to particularly notice. "Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city." It's that idea that God is not ashamed. He's not ashamed. This infinite, eternal being is not ashamed to be associated with this fallen flesh that have come unto him. He's not ashamed. Why is he not ashamed? Because they believe what he said and they acted accordingly. That's the essence of the verses in Hebrews chapter 11. They believed what he said, and they acted accordingly. I had some concerns when I got up this morning that I was going to be done before the time was allotted, and I thought, well, that's going to be a bit embarrassing. But I realize now about the other problem, so that's okay. The second class is actually quite a bit shorter than the first and the third, and we're not done yet, so don't pack up your Bibles yet. I believe we go to a quarter two, is that correct? But I will stop on time, but we won't be completely finished the first class, but the second class isn't quite as long, so I think by the end of the second class, will probably be pretty much back on schedule, plus I will have some time to think in between if we have to streamline anything. But this is the verse where, one of the key verses, where this visiting the Gentiles was made, as recorded in the book of Genesis. It's not the time of Abraham's call from Ur, but it is the time that he was given the covenant of circumcision, which gave a physical differentiation between the males who were not Gentiles and those who were, that, as we know, continues through even into the pages of the New Testament. And it's also the first place where the precious couplet is introduced in the scripture, so I'd like to read it with you. As for me, behold, my covenant is with thee, and thou shalt be a father of many nations. Neither shall thy name any more be called Abram, but thy name shall be Abraham, for a father of many nations have I made thee. And I will make thee exceeding fruitful, and I will make nations of thee, and kings shall come out of thee. And I will establish my covenant between me and thee, and thy seed after thee, and their generations, for an everlasting covenant, to be a God unto thee, and to thy seed after thee. And I will give unto thee, and to thy seed after thee, the land wherein thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. Now, it's only half of the couplet that's introduced here. The phrase is introduced for the first time in Scripture, I will be their God. So a lot of questions arise as we think about that. Whose God did God say he was going to be in the context? And if you look at your handout, you'll notice that there are two right-hand columns. One says covenant and one says land. And we're not going to do the exercise here. We don't have time to go through each verse and see if they make reference to covenant or land. But those columns are there so that if you wanted to, you could put a check mark every time the precious couplet occurs in Scripture, in which it is found in the context of the covenant and in which there is a reference to land. And as a study tool, you could add other columns and look for other things which are common to the occurrence of the precious couplet. But right here at the beginning, where it's first used, at least in part, we have a reference to the land as an everlasting possession, an everlasting inheritance, and we have a reference to the fact that this was going to be bequeathed or assured by means of an everlasting covenant which God made with Abraham. So let's look at our premises here. God has revealed himself to be the God of the seed of Abraham, to whom he is joined by his covenant. When he says that he is their God, the pronoun there in plural, in that verse is referring back to the seed of Abraham. That's whose God he said he's going to be. He's going to be the God of Abraham and Abraham's seed. So that's defined right in the passage. The multitude, in Hebrew, the word for multitude is Haman. And that's why Abram's name was changed to Abraham. The last part of his name is that word for many. It's that word that expresses the multitude that is in corporate, the seed being plural, in Abraham's name. God is therefore, at this time in history, identified as the God of part of the human race, that part of which Abraham is the father. But he's not then, as a logical conclusion, he's not the God of the non-Abrahamic balance, generally known in the scriptures as the Gentiles. Now, some of you might say, no, stop right there, because it says over in Romans 3, specifically, the question is asked, is he the God of the Jews only? Is he not the God of the Gentiles? And Paul says, yes, he is the God of the Gentiles. So how can you say that he's only the God of the seed of Abraham? Well, that's a question we're going to deal with in our third class. It's a valid question, but I think the answer to that question really unravels what is called in the New Testament scriptures a mystery, and we'll talk about that when we get to our third class. I'd like to end up this class by talking a little bit about the concept of inclusiveness versus exclusiveness, because I would suggest to you, in my experience, and I think in the experience of others, perhaps in your experience, in the contemporary society in which we live, the one thing that is the most objectionable in the minds of many people to the truth we hold, it's the concept of exclusiveness. When people learn that we think the truth is an exclusive thing in some form, that God has given a true understanding, and there's an absolute truth and an absolute true understanding in this book, and that that is separating the human race into people that God is choosing to work with and people that are just dying to perish. That concept is a very objectionable one. And without going into a lot of detail, I would suggest to you it is really at the root of the phenomenon of anti-Semitism, because the human race rejects the idea that God would have chosen the Jews as a people with which to work. And that produces a great deal of negativity. And so there is a paradox in the scriptures, because the Bible is actually a totally inclusive book. It is exclusive and it's inclusive at the same time. And those who react negatively to exclusiveness, I don't think have thought about its inclusiveness. And there's many ways we could try to explain that, but Acts chapter 10 is very clear that the invitation of the gospel was given to every race under heaven. That's the invitation. It's inclusive of all of the 6.8 billion or 6.7 billion people that now dwell on the face of the earth. None are intrinsically excluded from the invitation. But there is a condition attached in Acts 10, and that is anyone who fears him and does what is right is acceptable to God. So there has to be a response. So I would suggest it to you this way. The invitation issued by God is inclusive. The response made by man is what makes it exclusive, because only those responses by man that are in accordance with this understanding of the will of God are acceptable to him. And that is what makes the dividing line between inclusiveness and exclusiveness. It's the response that we make to God's invitation. We're the ones that, you might say, define the exclusiveness by our choices, if they are, to reject the offer of life that God has made in his word. Now, we could make an analogy here, and this little thing on the corner is just an arbitrary wedding invitation pulled off the internet. No particular significance to it. But we all know how those who are parents, perhaps mother of the bride or the bride herself, know some of the challenges. If you only have so many guests to your wedding, how do you determine who to send the invitations to and who not to? And in God's wisdom and mercy, his invitation has gone out to all flesh, is invited to participate in the program he has to seek man, to bring men who are seeking him unto himself. And it's man's response that is defining who is going to be included in that program. Ultimately, yes, God is going to make up his jewels, but he's given us the basis on which that's going to be done. So I want to leave that thought with you, and we'll regroup in 15 minutes for class 2.